Thank you, Ms. Samples. I must say that the earlier part of your introduction began to turn my head a bit. I recognize familiar forms of that I have learned in various situations to say, uh-oh, hold on, I needn't. That is to feel guilty that I wasn't either black or poor or Indian. I hadn't known that specific invitations were to go out to minority or oppressed or third world groups, but I'll do my best. By the end of the hour, I'll at least refer to green people, and that has some meaning. The title of my talk. I have three titles. One, will community life survive in our supergalactic metropolises beyond the year 1975? Or is there life after Jaws and the Towering Inferno? Or how I escaped from megalopolitan madness and found happiness in my own neighborhood commune, in my little house on the Minneapolis prairie, and I'll kick anyone in the teeth who says it isn't so. Now, obviously, from the title, I have biases. And they're unabashed biases. They can be summed up in the same single word that will sum, in which I'll sum them up at the end. I'm an unabashed cosmopolitan with roots. And my commitment is to a metropolitan area, as large and chaotic it seems to the eyes immediately. The general title of this series, Metro 2000, implies that we can look ahead 25 years in order to plan, predict our collective social condition, both humanely and realistically. Is it possible to do this with regard to such seemingly subjective relationships as the quality of urban life? And my answer is, in part, yes, but only if we avoid the pitfalls of social science fiction crystal ball gazing, social astrology, and other alleged arts. In a recent issue of the New York Review of Books, Robert Scholes, writing in defense of science fiction as a valid way of reading the future, argued, quote, "To live well in the present, to live decently and humanely, we must see into the future," end quote. To which the literary critic Michael Wood replied, quote, "It seems more likely that to live at all in the future, we need to see into the present," end quote. That last statement is a more prosaic sentiment than the futurological apocalyptic style, which offers all the thrills of empathized disaster, but which is hardly helpful in informing us about our present arrangements, let alone telling us what we must do in the future. Books like Charles Reich's The Greening of America or Toffler's Future Shock offer as magnificent an array of thrills as that available to any pre-adolescent viewing a horror film especially made for that age group. A description of present urban community life, however, does not reveal, to me at least, either the heady organic sights and sounds of consciousness 3, that is the green commune as our inevitable destiny, nor does it suggest communities driven mad by information overloads. What is there in the present shape and state of community relationships that might bind us to the coming years, and what is there that permits us to see inconsistencies in our actions that may well lead us to produce more problems as we believe we are resolving old ones? My remarks from here on can be divided into three linked parts. One, the imagined predictions made about our present urban condition by some social thinkers about 50 years ago, including some who have attracted a large popular following and now are perform a kind of aged dean role, such as Lewis Mumford. These forecasts 50 years ago were just as thrilling as the same types are today, and quite wrong about the relationships between growing urban populations and the resultant pattern of community life. Unfortunately, in my judgment, their sentiments were and are also shared by many contemporary citizens and popular leaders. It is a view that is basically bucolic and anti-urban And while a great many people get their kicks from cursing the big city, their actions, that is, their metropolitan trips to and from home, their patterns of friendship and kinship, their residential choices, often fly directly contrary to their thrilling beliefs. Then secondly, I'd like to describe for you something that you may already be aware of, but in some detail, a description of the metropolitanization of populations worldwide in the United States and in the Twin Cities. And then thirdly, I'd like to comment on relationships between this increase, amazing increase of urban scale in which we lead our lives and our prospects for community life, more localized existence. The first topic, predictions of urban disaster made about our own time, some 25 to 50 years ago. You may remember recently, just as an aside, that a strong box in a cornerstone of a building was opened up. A cornerstone had been laid some 30 years ago, I believe, and was opened up, and the predictions about our time that were made then were read. And mostly they turned out to be quite wrong. A few were correct. And what people have written about our urban community life likewise tends to have the same very varied characteristics concerning the validity of those prophecies. But a summary statement of what some social thinkers wrote, not all, there were some who saw better than others, but some who didn't see quite well, but whose works became very popular, what they wrote. In summary form, their predictions were, and you note how thrilling it is to think of this. One, as increasing numbers of people flocked to industrialized cities, all community life would be destroyed. The city would become a nest for strangers, and the more urbanized the people would be, the more strange they would become to one another. Two, three major characteristics of urban life determined the nature or the quality of the urban chaos that was sure to follow. One, the large numbers of people. Two, the high population density. And three, the heterogeneity of population types with regard to ethnicity, income, race, occupation, lifestyle. This would inevitably cause the breakdown of traditional values, the dissolution of the family, the destruction of neighboring and of trust among neighbors, and would also cause crime to increase as well as mental disease, violence, and social distress. Now, how thrilling it really is. I'm serious about it. When I read predictions like that, chills go up my spine, and like other sorts of chills, there is a big audience that went to see Jaws and the Towering Inferno. You go because it's chilling. And people read and said, how awful, as they felt satisfied. Three, the inner areas of the city would become disorganized slums with little order, cultivation, or culture. They would become ghettos for barbarians. The suburbs would, and are, become isolated prisons for mothers and disaster areas for children, both of whom are deprived of any natural or vital community life. Now, Margaret Mead makes a hell of a lot of money going around scaring mothers who live in the suburbs and who then say, my God, that's me. Four, one of the most significant indicators of the big city, namely the multifamily habitat, the apartment building, the high rise, would, does, breed alienation, social malaise, and crime. Now, bits of this horror prediction have been with us ever since Thomas Jefferson. William Jennings Bryan was perhaps the most famous prophet of urban disaster, and this scary scenario provides a constant source of horror conversation among some sectors of society, some rural people, some small town folk, some city people even. In fact, this view is all too common, especially nowadays. Journalists write it into their news stories, radio stations regularly broadcast it, and this view has found its way, I think unfortunately, my own bias, into the credo of some environmentalist movements. It is especially strong in the upper Midwest and in the Twin Cities area in particular. It is an ideology, a collective representation of social evil, helpful in mobilizing people against a foe, real or imagined, and hence useful, and yielding rewards of tribal self-justification. But the truth, it is not. Now, it is not my purpose here to discuss in detail the social scientific research which disproves these predictions, nor is there time. but some summaries of such research might be helpful. One, community life is not destroyed in industrialized cities, nor in post-industrial cities. It is alive and well and thriving, albeit often different than some imagined forms of rural or small town community life, or than local neighborhood communities in cities 50 years ago. Two, while urbanized populations contain a larger potential set of strangers than do rural or small town populations, they also obviously contain a larger potential set of friends and acquaintances. The proportion of actual ties that people make in a big city, that is, friends and acquaintances, as against strangers, is not significantly different at all than the proportion in non-urban areas. Moreover, in smaller cities and towns, the tendency is to define those who aren't in one's immediate kinship and friendship circle as strangers, while in urban settings, the role of the stranger and the definition of who is stranger and who is acquaintance is more vague and loose. There are many more candidates for friendship relationships in the big city than in the small town. Three, neither population size, nor population density, nor heterogeneity of population cause or are directly correlated with increases in crime, mental disease, violence, or social distress. Now that's, to my scientific satisfaction, that's been proved absolutely, and I'd be willing to discuss it with anyone afterward. Four, the inner cities, the urban ghettos of the poor, the black, the red, the disadvantaged, are not barbarian ghettos. They constitute organized communities. They're often more subtly and delicately encultured and socially formed than our populations in other areas of the metropolitan field. Children and mothers alike thrive or are distressed, neither more nor less because they live in the suburbs, nor is there any detectable deprivation of natural community patterns in the suburbs. Five, apartment buildings, high rises, as such, simply do not cause, nor are even statistically associated with, alienation, lack of neighborliness, malaise, or crime. People who have had many neighbors and who are accustomed to living a rich community life in low-rise buildings and then move into high-rise buildings will have similar degrees of neighboring and enjoy similar community life in tall buildings, so long as other social characteristics are similar in their habitat of origin. That is, if you take a 55-year-old widow who has lived all her life in a town of 1,000 people in western Minnesota and move her to a Twin Cities high-rise for the elderly, she may have more difficulty neighboring than her urban-bred next-door neighbor, obviously. Now, some characteristics of the metropolitanization of populations, my second major topic. In all societies, first, the world over, there has been an amazing increase in scale. If one talks about a revolution in patterns of social life, of lifestyles, the most significant short-range change has come about through metropolitanization. Just a few figures on this. For the world as a whole, an estimated 23% of the population resided in cities of 100,000 or more in 1972. 100,000 seems to be an agreed-on figure as the difference between a large and a medium-sized city. 1972, then 23% of the world's population resided in cities of 100,000 or more, compared with about 19% in 1960 and 16% in 1950. The trend toward not only urbanization, but especially metropolitanization, appears to be universal. By the year 2000, the target date of this meeting, the proportion of the world's population projected to reside in metropolitan centers is about two-fifths. In terms of absolute numbers, this increase will be from about 863 million people in 1970 to about 2.7 billion in the year 2000. Two, the number of large cities, that is cities over 100,000, will in all probability double by the year 2000, and large cities will grow larger in size. As I go on, you'll see I'm developing some analogies to astrophysics, and I'm going to refer to galaxies and so on. And in the same way that astronomers always seem to be discovering an outer edge to the world, which to the universe, which seem to have an edge, galaxies upon galaxies, and further galaxies yet, and hints of super galaxies through detection of various radio waves, so too. Beyond the year 2000, I even hesitate to talk about the increase in scale. The average size, for example, concerning large cities, the average size of large cities in 1970 was about 500,000 inhabitants. By 2000, the average size is expected to be 648,000. Now for the United States. And here, let's become just a bit more technical in definitions and refer to, again, something which many of you may have familiarity with, Standard Metropolitan Statistical Areas, or SMSAs for short. That's a unit devised by the U.S. Bureau of the Census, at least two decades ago, to map the development of this significant social movement. That is, the appearance naturally in Western Europe and in Asian societies of large-scale urbanized agglomerations, but beyond the size of the city, called vaguely metropolitan areas, was noted by census bureaus. And in order to chart its growth, an artificial term called the SMSA, the Standard Metropolitan Statistic Area, was devised. And with passing census years, with each decennial census, the definition has to become slightly more complex. And the definition can become rather cumbersome. But the main parts of it are as follows. Begin with, one, a county in the United States which contains a city of at least 50,000 people in size. And then add to that first beginning, two, those contiguous counties where at least 75% of the labor force is employed in non-agricultural occupations. And then three, add to it something very important, where the people living in those areas maintain regular social and economic contacts that result in some integration of the outlying counties with the central city county, and you have an SMSA. Now, by the 1970 census, there were 243 such SMSAs in the 50 states and four more in Puerto Rico. Within less than 3 years, and you can catch a sense of the growth rate in our country, 20 more SMSAs had come into being, so that a year ago, there were 267 SMSAs. And the addition grows at a rate each year, that is at a rate of increasing growth. Then, another item, 68.6% of the total 1970 population of the United States of 203 million, now we have some 213 million people, but 68.6% of that in 1970 resided in SMSAs. By 2000, by the year 2000, our target year, 85% of the population of the United States will reside in such areas. Of that 85%, 54% will be living in two of the largest of such galaxies, to be called perhaps super galaxies, namely the Northeast Atlantic to Chicago galaxy, stretching from New England down to Virginia along the coast, and then across to Chicago via Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio. And 13% will reside in the West Coast, such super galaxy, from San Francisco to San Diego. Now, beyond the SMSA, metropolitan complexes of galaxies have been identified, and they have been designated by the Census Bureau as standard consolidated areas, and you see how this grows on itself, such as the New York, New Jersey area and the Chicago complex. Now, although the Census Bureau has identified such units, you may ask, are they really real? Or are they fictional monsters? Are they medieval chimeras? Monsters that you find in a horror movie? And my answer to that would be they are at least as real as outer space galaxies are. They exist because systematic relationships among social and economic groups and groupings, including business corporations, neighborhood associations, friends, lovers, are all subtly interwoven with one another, with identifiable boundaries to such networks at the outer edges of the social mass of each of these galaxies. Such metropoli and metropolitan galaxies are perhaps the most archetypical ones for now and until the year 2000. And so, I mean archetypical in the sense that most of the kind of forces that affect us in our everyday lives and in our lifetime concerns are apt to come from involvement, our involvement in such galaxies. How does the structure of such entities differ from that of old-fashioned cities? Briefly put, linkages among its component parts, linkages among groups, among institutions, even among bundles of trips to and from home, are more complex and have increased in quantum jumps of scale over that used to exist in cities. The French geographer Jean Gottman, who applied the term megalopolis to this amoeba, and it does look like an amoeba, as you'll see briefly, and this megalopolis has different names. The English give it a slightly obscene-sounding name. They call it a conurbation. And American scholars have termed it, recently, American scholars have simply termed it an urban field, so that when I use the term megalopolis as Gutman devised it, or urban field, I mean the same thing. I mean what I'm describing metaphorically as a supergalaxy. But Gutman described some of the more everyday life situations in such a system as follows. And reading from his book, Megalopolis, which was published now, it was published in 1961. You can see I can't subtract well. He said, separation between place of work and place of residence creates within the area the system of daily tidal movements involved in commuting. Over these are superimposed other currents, some seasonal and some irregularly recurrent. These reflect relations between different parts of megalopolis that stem from more complicated needs than the simple journey from home to work. These other needs grow far more complicated and more general as average family income rises and both goods and activities that were once considered indispensable come to be regarded as necessary by large numbers of the megalopolitans. New patterns of intense living that have become normal in megalopolis affect not only land use, they also exert a strong influence on the economic and social foundations of society. The density of activities and of movement of all kinds, and underline that, I'll come back to that again because that's the crucial ingredient here, the density of activities and of movement of all kinds is certainly the most extraordinary feature of megalopolis, more characteristic even than the density of population and of skyscrapers. My own feeling is that if tall buildings or skyscrapers or what symbolically represent anything, they don't represent the dominance of capitalists over proletarians or whites over non-whites, but they represent simply the density of increased activity patterns that a megalopolis in general is. The many millions of people, says Gutman, who find themselves neighbors in megalopolis, even though they live in different states and hundreds of miles from one another, are barely becoming aware of the imperatives of such a neighborhood. Responsible public opinion, obviously that's a biased term, that's a euphemism for public opinion that I share, and that is not shared by others critical of it, but that's what he says. Responsible public opinion is becoming conscious of the problems involved, and the struggle to find solutions has started. It is especially difficult because no one problem can be tackled without affecting others. Transportation, land use, water supply, cultural activities, use and development of resources, government and politics, all are interrelated. Megalopolis stands indeed at the threshold of a new way of life, and upon solution of its problems will rest civilization's ability to survive. Now, I would agree with Gutman, even some 24 years ago that we're only dimly aware, most of us in our public imagination, of the kind of problems we're involved in, and for reasons that the megalopolis stretches so far. And this causes, creates, some severe problems in the relationship between our action and our beliefs about our problems, which I'll get into briefly. Before I proceed any further to examine the Twin Cities area, I must point out two things about these passages from Gutmann. One, note well Gutmann's focus on density of activity or interaction as the most extraordinary feature of this development. This is not population density. It's quite different. It's, if you want the mathematical type term, imagine in the denominator of this concept, in the lower portion of the fraction, the sum total of possible interactions among people in any area. And that's given by the size of the population. And then in the numerator, the top part of the fraction, imagine the sum total of actual interactions in the area. And then you have a figure which represents the density of activity or interaction in an area. And this is much more important than population density itself for a consideration of what goes on in the quality of life in the metropolis. Says another commentator on the scene, with which I agree absolutely, one myth about the urban future should be laid to rest, namely that masses of people will be living piled on top of one another. The urban, that is the city densities of the United States have been declining since at least 1880. Now, that may startle some of you, but happens to be the case. Densities in Minneapolis and St. Paul have been declining for some time. Indeed, on the question of population density and crime, it turns out the population densities of some of our most crime-ridden cities have been dramatically decreasing. You can make a stronger statistical correlation about increasing crime rates and decreasing population densities than the other way around. As in the Twin Cities area, population density has been evening out, so to speak, decreasing at the center and increasing at the edges of our urban field, our galaxy. But as population density decreases in the cities, say the Twin Cities themselves, relationships, ties, interaction among people and among groups, that is, interaction density, or what is called network density, increases across the total field. The galaxy is heating up. Let me just run over that one again, because it sounds like a very curious paradox. Population density is decreasing in the city centers themselves. Across the metropolitan field, it's evening out. I don't have a blackboard for you, or else I could draw it for you. Technically, this is called a decline in the slope of density gradients. It's happening in every major city or every metropolitan area across the world. If you look at a slope, the geometric slope on an X and Y axis, where you're measuring on the horizontal axis at the bottom, on the X axis, you're measuring starting from the center, starting from zero, and then going out, you're measuring miles or area units, 1 mile, 2 miles, 3 miles from the center, and then on the vertical axis, we're measuring numbers of people. In the early phases of the development of a city, the slope is very steep. There are many more people packed toward the middle than there are toward the edge. And for that same city, follow it in decade periods of time, 1900, 1910, 1920, for Chicago, for the Twin Cities, and the slope gradually evens off like that. So, population densities decline at the center, and they extend out in the middle, evening off like that. But something quite different happens with action densities, or with network densities. As the metropolitan area grows in size, then interaction among people increases, as population density decreases. Now that catches us in a kind of crunch, and what we'll make of it will develop a little further. Part of the reason for this, you can imagine some of the reasons for it. Part of the reasons are technological. Daily, we invent new methods of reaching one another. At first, we had a telephone line. Now, obviously, we have Watts lines. The cost of communicating one with the other, each of us, goes continually down as technological developments with regard to communication increase. As you add new technologies which occupy different aspects of wavelength spectra, radio stations, TV, FM stations, ultra-high, cable TV, the possibilities of communication all increase geometrically. Then with transportation, 1900, 1890, development of public transportation, that does something very drastic with settlement patterns. It also increases the interaction of one of us to of any one of us to each other. Add to that then the advent of the automobile, then double the number of automobiles in average middle class, upper class families, and then increase the possibilities of other such trips, and you have something else added with regard to the potential for interaction. Now, most importantly, consider the changing nature of economic life and the fact that more and more economic life, any business corporation, any hospital, any insurance corporation, involves much more of some interaction situation. It may not have to be a physical face-to-face contact. In fact, most often it's not. But computerization, computerized billing, computerized accounting, computerized ordering increases in many magnitudes of scale the kinds of interactions that go on among people. And this involves us all in behavior nets of increasing types. Now, these are gross size and shape characteristics. They are also descriptions of the intensity and extensity of social interactions across the urban field in general. Now, let's do something. Let's forget about this general sort of thing and look at something that occupies much more of our imagination when we think of community life. If we focus suddenly only on one aspect of this metropolitan network of activity, our residential locales and lives. By the word locale now, I mean a specific area, a local area, a neighborhood, which refers to area. Community refers to population, not necessarily to a local area. If we focus suddenly on our residential locales and lives, we learn, of course, that the actual social and civic reality of our daily lives is of smaller compass than this. The megalopolis and the urban field are real in the sense that they represent interdependence and in the sense that the effect of the urban galaxy is felt hundreds of miles from the center, almost like a series of elaborate electromagnetic fields. And also, the effect is felt, in fact, by the centrifugal rush of population to the outer edges of the field. And this, in problem terms, we call urban sprawl. This has left us, however, most of us, living in incorporated or legal political units, exercising local authority, which are comparatively small in population size, and which are basically related to only one segment of our actions, namely our residential habitats. Now, it is this basic structural split between the large extent of the metropolitan galaxy that affects us, into which we are intertwined, and which we affect by our daily actions, and on the other hand, the comparatively restricted extent of our static residential commitments. It's that gap, which permits many people to behave one way and to believe, feel, imagine another way. And such behavior is well nigh universal among us. I don't exempt myself from that. I'm saying that it's almost determined. I'm saying that very few of us have sufficient breadth or courage to reconcile our daily action with our mobilized beliefs. Thus, the neighborhood counterculture group that insists that rehabilitation of single dwelling units and one-for-one replacement of housing by locals is the only way to preserve urban community is no better, in my mind, than the suburbanite who moves ever further out to enjoy lower taxes while commuting to the Central Business District to work and play. In both cases, each is basically committed to self-interest, that is, to gain most at lowest cost for himself. And this, no matter what kinds of more noble ideologies each of them uses to justify his actions, and no matter what kinds of moralistic editorials are written in the local press for or against either group. In both cases, in the case of the counterculture group insistent on rehabilitating one-for-one residents with local labor, which may not be so local, in both cases, each is attempting to slough off the costs of making that kind of decisions to other groups. In economic terms, each type of action engenders externality costs, hopefully to be borne by others. In the case of the local counterculture group, the one-for-one replacement of housing might seem to be sentimentally a pretty good thing, but given the underbuilding and the dissaving in the housing industry and the growing need for housing by the year 2000, we're going to have such a deficit of housing that the one-for-one replacement is going to increase by geometric magnitudes the costs of building communities in non-sprawl situations for future generations. In both cases also, such behavior, both the case of the suburbanite who increasingly moves out to lower taxes and lower costs, and the other case, such behavior leads to exclusionary attitudes, to actions aimed at preserving the locale only for the tribal group's lifestyle. In all such cases, the mobilized localistic political actions and ideologies do not square with the pattern of large-scale interaction across the urban field. Now for the Twin Cities. Let us look at some growth patterns in the Twin Cities metropolitan field. Here are four successive overlays of growth and density patterns, one for 1900, one for 1940, one for 1956, and a projection to 1980. This is not my work. These are taken from a now classic article on Twin Cities by my colleague in geography, John Borchard. And my purpose in showing you this is not to go into any depth analysis, but just to demonstrate to you how the amoeba has grown. This is 1900, and the cross-hatched, the various cross-hatched patterns represent different degrees of density, but not density of population and not activity density either, but density of dwelling unit density. 1900, you could clearly identify, but I should say there is a correlation between dwelling unit density and population density, not interaction. 1900, you could clearly identify the nodes of population of dwelling unit location really as being involved in a city. There are two separate nodes, the edges, the eastern edge of Minneapolis, the western edge of St. Paul, clearly seem to divide. There's some osmosis going on, that some immediate inference would be that fission of some kind is taking place, not necessarily fusion. And the other thing to note is that the areas of highest density are isomorphic with, structurally consistent with, the boundary of the city. And then the outer edges of the bull's ring of the target are comparatively small. You can see the development of, in amoeba terms, referring to the amoeba of pseudopods, of legs that seem to be growing radially, St. Paul in the east, and then, of course, southwest to Minnetonka and the lakes in Minneapolis. But you can note also there's hardly any southern growth, and there's limited northern growth, especially in St. Paul. Now, switch to 1940, and you can see something suddenly else is taking shape. The pseudopods are beginning to expand, and they expand in many different directions, and there's a geometric lesson that you may have noted already that I'll talk about more specifically, namely, along with the expansion in that way, of pseudopods radially. By pseudopods, I just mean the apparent semi-shapeless, semi-shaped legs and arms. Note the amount of surface at the outer edges as the pseudopods take on variegated shape. With increasing shape And with increasing circumference at the outer edge, geometrically you can predict how much area will be exposed at the outer edge to the rural surround, the rural hinterland. And the other thing to note about this is how the density pattern already, density of dwelling unit, is beginning to level off by 1940. And you can tell by the fact that the outer lighter density areas are expanding in relation to the central city densities, meaning that the density slope is already declining by 1940. Next, 1956. And you can see rather extended growth, much more extended growth even before, growth in large scale in more or less every which direction. And then finally, the 1980 projection. And this is what you see. And it's obvious that extensive urbanization is taking place, and also that the internal area of this amoeba is growing extensively geometrically, and the nature of the pseudopods also presents more surface at the outer edges. Now that gives you some sense of metropolitanization and what is meant by this. Extend this to the year 2000, and the consolidated Twin Cities area that I'm going to talk about extends in the east to Eau Claire, and in the west out to western Minnesota, and in the south to the Iowa border. As of 1970, the Twin Cities SMSA was the 15th largest such SMSA in the nation, with a population of 1,800,000. But, talking about firsts, between 1960 and 1970, in the decade just up to 1970, there was an increase of 23% in the population. That is an increase of some 350,000 people. Now, only two metro areas in the country grew at a larger rate than the Twin Cities in that decade, and most of them were rather unique and don't represent the normal type of metro center. Washington, D.C. and Houston both grew by being pumped up with large amounts of federal monies. Although population and the Twin Cities SMSA rate of growth had slowed down some, still, if you project this growth rate, 1970, of the Twin Cities urban field, the galaxy, to the year 2000, from number 15, we should become ninth in size, in overall size, in the nation. Now, what should be clearly understood is that we are not talking about the same people, say, over a five-year period, when we refer to the population. Like other urban fields, the Twin Cities population is ever-changing. There are complex in and out migration flows to and from this area. And it's a fascinating story. The Upper Midwest Council has some publications in the field, partially from which I'm drawing, in multicolored lovely maps, and they might be available for you to look at. Most of this tidal flow of populations, that is of people who claim their residence in this area, is to and from other places in the Upper Midwest, and a good deal of it is related to variations of different age groups and stages in the family cycle. For many young single people in the Upper Midwest, the Twin Cities metropolis is a staging area for later dispersal, as many of you parents know. Interestingly, however, apart from the Upper Midwest, other metropolitan areas exchange populations with this area. Now, for curiosity reasons alone, I cannot explain this. Let me just recite some other areas of the nation from which there has been a net outflow from those areas to the Twin Cities. That is, we take in more of their people than we export to those cities, and then cities in which there's net outflow from here to them. There's been a net inflow to the Twin Cities metro area from the following: Chicago, Milwaukee, Omaha, Detroit, Cleveland, Columbus, and New York City. More New Yorkers come here than we export to New York, to the New York City metropolitan area. There has been a net outflow from here during that same period to Boston, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh gets me, because the crime rate in Pittsburgh is so much higher than the crime rate in the Twin Cities area, just for example. And the quality of life index of Pittsburgh is so much below our quality of life index. Nevertheless, Pittsburgh appears as getting more of our people than we get theirs. Washington, D.C., for obvious purposes. Indianapolis, for reasons I can't fathom. But then Denver, St. Louis. Pittsburgh gets me, because the crime rate in Pittsburgh is so much higher than the crime rate in the Twin Cities area, just for example. And the quality of life index of Pittsburgh is so much below our quality of life index. Nevertheless, Pittsburgh appears as getting more of our people than we get theirs. Washington, D.C., for obvious purposes. Indianapolis, for reasons I can't fathom. But then Denver, St. Louis, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Honolulu, and Phoenix. In all probability, the pattern of growth, as I've described it, will continue in this way to the year 2000 in general terms. And that's the usual social scientific admonition, other things being equal. Unless, of course, the energy shortage becomes critical, and it would have to become much more critical than it is now, incidentally, for a change to come about. Some studies have been done on what changes would occur in this straight line model projection under increasing shortages of energy, and the predictions are that we'd really have to be on empty gasoline tanks before the population shifts and the extent of metropolitan sprawl would begin to decrease. So unless that occurs, and depending also on various economic considerations, especially housing conditions. And as I've said, since the Twin Cities metropolitan area has grown so in amount of net in-migration, and especially in interaction patterns, the number of housing starts is abysmally short for the total area of what is expected. Now, that may tend to change the shape. Now, some geometric models concerning possible consequences. And just all you have to know is geometry. Although you don't even have to remember any geometry. You don't even have to remember pi r square. Just imagine what you saw on the screen. One, as urban sprawl continues at the outer edge and amoeba-like extends itself with radial pseudopods, more and more surface appears at the circumference. And in the middle and outer rings of the field, that is inside the field and at the middle and outer rings, there is more space between population centers. If we added nothing else to this picture or model, it would represent an extremely intensive energy-consuming system. And incidentally, this model represents much more Los Angeles than it does New York or Boston. After all, I noted previously that interaction patterns, activity patterns, increase, and now we note that space between residential units also increases on the average. The consequence with regard to energy consumption is obvious. Any of several other factors may change the model, however. So, for example, localized implosions of population within the field, aggregations of population around distinct service centers at a greater rate than what is now the case could occur. And also the authority system might change. That is, such planning and coordinating units as the Metropolitan Council might be given more authority to help govern the shape of this sprawl. It seemed that this might occur some years ago. Now it is highly problematic, mostly due to more localized pressures and what I have termed the new localism, which has intervened, militating against granting more authority to any Metropolitan Council, elected or not. And resentment has mobilized against this alleged monster, this super galaxy I have described, of which we are all a part. But what is the relationship between these large-scale developments and community life? Now I come to the third part of my remarks. I have already argued that, so far as I read the scientific research on the question, urbanization does not destroy community. Quite the contrary. My reading of this research and my own research leads me to the conclusion that the net effect of urbanization, and especially of metropolitanization, is to create, extend, and strengthen many types of community relationships. Of course, this depends on how you choose to define the word community. If you choose to define it only in tribalistic terms, meaning a set of people who share with each other all ties, who are at one and the same time friends, neighbors, lovers, acquaintances, workmates, kinfolk, and who share similar beliefs and values, then this type of community is not preeminent in any metropolitan field that I know of in the world. It exists, it is not destroyed, but as a proportion of such communities to other community relationships, it is not preeminent. But usually, this view of the community, which is often confused with Saturday Evening Post covers, usually this view of the community is positively valued, that is declared to be valuable, highly desirable, and is erroneously considered to be characterized by peace, harmony, brotherhood and sisterhood, mutual tolerance, absence of crime, and a high degree of democracy for all members. Nowadays, of course, it may also include organic food, smallness, and all good things. And in the Twin Cities area, this conception is daily broadcast and idealized in the pages of the local press, especially in the university student and counterculture press. It comes with classical music fed by Minnesota Educational Radio each morning and evening, and is especially found in their journal preview, which, along with amazing recipes for bread, bread that's risen bread in the last issue, the gorgeous article on bread, along with some nasty comments on Kissinger, which follow one another, and Nancy. But the most significant recipe for the most organic bread, leavened bread, it said, left out to my expertise in bread baking, and I have some, one ingredient, yeast. And as I noted, this view forms a central part of the idealized but ideological quest for community which most of us, including myself, share. Conceived in this way, the term community is a fighting model, useful for neighborhood combat. In its verb form, however, it is conjugated thus. We have community, you have a humanly irresponsible society, and they, poor souls, have a dehumanized chaos. If, however, by community, we refer differently to any set of localized, desired interactions among people, and if we map the interaction patterns, a kaleidoscope of community structures is visible. Residential communities in metropolitan settings tend to become, in the phrase of Morris Janowitz of the University of Chicago, communities of limited liability. That is, habitats which include residents with a varied range of ties to others living in the same locale, and a varied range of ties to many in the whole metropolis. Some may use the neighborhood only as a temporary sleeping place, and others find in it neighbors, friends, and acquaintances. In between, people have varying degrees and types of relationships with those residing in the same physical area. If we consider the large number of such residential communities in any metropolis, and then consider other types of communities, communities of interest, communities of work, communities of belief, and note that all such communities intertwine, then the following possible conditions appear for the involvement of people in metropolitan community life. One, the ties people engage in may be done in the context of much wider choice than before, when metropolitan galaxies were smaller and when people lived in cities, not metropolises. And the larger and more specialized the metropolitan population, the greater the variety of choice. Now let me give you one simple example. Research on why people marry indicated up until some years ago, this is still the case, that the largest factor that explains why one person would marry another is propinquity. People marry because they live next to one another. some 50% or more, 56% of people in urban areas, as of research 15 years ago, married someone else within a 20-block area distant from each other. And this represented, to a certain extent, the force of residential community life itself. Now, when I look at that statistic and consider it morally, I say to myself, does that mean that the reason I married my wife is because she and I happen to live next to one another? That happened to be the case. What a commentary on the reason for marriage. And this happens to most of us. Now imagine, on the other hand, if you can do a simple capitalistic thing, you can increase the number of people who have access to the marriage market, number of people of different types. Then what you're doing is lowering the cost to you of surveying the field before you make a choice. And what you're doing then for large numbers of people is diminishing propinquity itself as a reason for marriage and increasing the possibility that people marry because they will and choose to marry someone whom they've tested as against others. Now that's a very old capitalist adage, but applied to this situation, I think there's some validity to the analogy. Secondly, the impact of this for community life, particular types of relations and patterns for any single individual, that is particular types such as acquaintance networks, kinship networks, neighboring networks, will tend to vary by income, by occupation, by age group, rather than by locale. Thirdly, if we draw a map of the different types of bundles of ties I am calling community that people engage with in a metro area, then the network bundles themselves will vary with regard to the physical space spanned by each type. That is, there may be commuter trips that people make back and forth from home to work that encompass, now it's not uncommon for people to make 50-mile commuter trips between work and home in the Twin Cities area. That's a long-distance tie, as against a short-distance tie of engaging in a work group network relationship in one's immediate office. So the ties will vary over physical space. They will vary in a metropolitan area by the number of people involved. Some will be small clique ties, small interest clique ties. Other will be very large-scale ties, such as university interaction ties. They will vary by the degree of intimacy of the relationship, from very intimate to a relationship which is not a stranger relationship, but which is not intimate. And fourthly, they'll vary by the internal structure of the relationship. Now, that's a difficult one offhand to get to, and I'm not going to get involved with it now. But some such bundles of relationship take the form of a closed star. Those are closed networks where people who neighbor with one another also do other things with one another and don't do those things with anyone else. But the archetypical metropolitan structure of such a network tie is different than that. It tends to be radial and not closed, open and not closed. Fourthly, far from disappearing, local communities are proliferating and shifting. And I would argue this is more in keeping with the behavior, if not the rhetoric, of most metropolitans. If the story I have told is not in accord with conventional images or beliefs, this is partly due to the greater inherent difficulty of imagining complex social relationships, of conceiving of social space as against physical space. It is far easier to say and to believe, I live in Prospect Park or I live in St. Anthony Park, than it is to designate the varied actual social linkages of which one is a part. City planning departments, both Minneapolis and St. Paul, also publish neighborhood maps for very necessary administrative purposes, but in which the cities are neatly laid out in checkered squares, dividing each set of square blocks into non-overlapping neighborhoods, each with its own name, Field, Regina, Bryn Mawr, and so on. And sets of such neighborhoods are then collected in non-overlapping communities like University Community, Powderhorn, and so on, each with its own name. But research on how people do in fact identify with their locales indicates much more blurring of boundaries, that is, the blurring that goes on in people's minds and in their action. Albert Hunter's research on symbolic identification of residents with neighborhoods in Chicago will show something quite different than your ordinary city neighborhood map, and which is characteristic of the Twin Cities as well. Says Hunter, local urban communities should not be viewed as immutable, static social units whose names, boundaries, and other defining characteristics may be permanently and authoritatively fixed. The mapping of local areas will inevitably be wrong because of historical change and because of the different criteria that observers or participants may use in their definitions. As individuals pass through the life cycle, their life space shifts, and symbolic definitions of local communities may be expected to reflect changes in individual biographies and resulting changes in patterns of local social interaction, utilization, orientation. The social world or symbolic community of an individual who as a child is not allowed to cross the street will change when he begins school, learns to drive a car, gets a job, raises a family, and retires. As individuals go about the routine of satisfying their daily needs, they come to occupy different social positions or statuses, or that in different situations, some statuses will be more salient than others. As individuals move from one status to another, from one institutional area to another, from one collectivity to another, the operating reference community is also likely to shift. Before I conclude, yet another set of conditions must be mentioned, conditions which also affect the difference between how we act in our large-scale urban field and how we feel about it. There is nothing that transforms a mere aggregate, a handful of residents who happen to inhabit the same physical area into a tribal community than a fight with another group, a government agency, a highway department, a developer. People with the most disparate interests, people whose neighbors are largely transient, will suddenly identify with each other, discover that they are blood brothers and sisters and have been so since birth, when mobilized for conflict. In fact, such a conflict helps to create a residential community when none was there to begin with. And the major reason for this refers back to a very old psychological law, the law of effect. People love it. People love nothing more than a community fight, no matter how much they complain about it. Ideologically, across the United States, we have seen the emergence of what I call the new localism, a cultural trend related to some of the very processes of metropolitanization itself. It's related to underbuilding and to deterioration of urban housing stocks. It's related to urban sprawl, to the mobility patterns and extensive ties that make a metropolitan area attractive to begin with. At the same time, we have witnessed some consequences of the new localism across the nation, which are not too pleasant, at least for me to contemplate. A new exclusionism, which resembles very much the old. For example, I find it very difficult to distinguish between the racist attitudes, say, of those in South Boston and Charleston, who at least have ancient ethnic homogeneity as an excuse, from those who wish to keep their neighborhoods, lily white, and on the other hand, those who wish to keep their neighborhoods organically green. The citizens of affluent neighborhoods in the Los Angeles metropolitan complex have thus far been very successful in excluding those who differ from themselves in income on the basis of some alleged environmentalist or green reason. And in the Twin Cities, we have seen impassioned mobilizations against locating handicapped people in one's own neighborhood, against halfway houses of every which kind, and certainly against any increase in population density. My final question then is, if we succeed in excluding every kind from our neighborhood but our own kind, where will all the other kinds go to live? Everybody answers to some other neighborhood, but not here. But what will become of the metropolis if each residential locale contains only our kind? What will become of the whole? I remain, as you can see, an unabashed cosmopolitan, but hopefully not without roots.